From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It is not easy to describe the big new book by writer Andrew Solomon. Solomon interviewed hundreds of parents of different children. Children with Down syndrome, with autism, dwarfism, and more. Transgender children, musical prodigies, children of rape, children who become criminals. Children of differences so diverse, they and their parents may not even want to be grouped together. But there is a common thread here, he says, through society and its outriders and how we approach difference. This hour, On Point, children who are born different, the parents who love them, and the society that struggles to understand. You can join the conversation. Are you raising a child who is profoundly different from you, from the rest of the family, from most of society? Have you been caught in the push-pull between society's hunger for conformity and its struggle to accept? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Andrew Solomon's big new book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. He won the National Book Award in 2001 for his book, The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. He's a lecturer in psychiatry at Cornell University, special advisor to Yale's Department of Psychiatry. His book just out is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Andrew Solomon in New York, thank you very much for joining us.
What a pleasure to be here.
You begin this book right off the bat, and I think it's a good place for us to begin as well. You say there's no such thing as reproduction. You're being a little bit cheeky there, but not really. What do you mean?
Well, my idea really is that we tend to think before we have children that what we're doing is reproducing, somehow extending ourselves into the future. But what we're really doing is producing someone entirely new. And all children carry within them a broad range of surprises. So my book looks particularly at families of children who are dramatically different from their parents, children with autism, children who are deaf, children who are dwarfs, children who are transgender. But my underlying point is that all parenthood involves being abruptly catapulted into a relationship with a stranger.
We like the word reproduction, you say, because of this implication that two people are just braiding themselves together. It's kind of euphemism, you write, to comfort prospective parents. But as you say, it ultimately pushes them into a permanent relationship with a stranger. And you make no bones about it. In the way you're discussing it, some children more stranger than others. I don't mean that in any disparaging way, just more different than others.
Yes, there's no question about that. There are many parents who have children who have an identity which is foreign or alien to their parents. So many kinds of identity, what I've called vertical identities, are hereditary. Your ethnicity, your nationality, your language, many of those identities you share with your parents. But I, as the gay child of straight parents, had an identity that was alien to my parents. And when I was sent by the New York Times to report on the deaf and discovered that most deaf children are born to hearing parents, that they often have a sense of being quite alienated from those parents and then find cultural identity when they meet other deaf people and begin using sign language, I thought, oh, it's quite similar. And then a friend of mine had a daughter who was a dwarf. And there it was again. Most dwarfs are born to parents of average height. And many of those parents then don't know, should I get involved with the little people of America? Should I tell my child she's just like everyone else, only shorter? And I saw it over and over again, this idea that the child has to learn identity from a peer group rather than from parents.
This is a book for which you interviewed, 300-some families, sets of parents, sometimes their children as well, about what it was like. And just to go down, I mean, you've pulled together here quite a circle. I mean, even beyond what we normally think of. You have the deaf, dwarfs, Down syndrome, autism, schizophrenia, disability, prodigies, musical and otherwise, children of rape, children who end up as criminals, transgender children. What's the response? We're so happy to have you today because we've heard you around, but we really want to open the phone lines to exactly this kind of family, to parents who have gone through this, and give them the chance to interact with you, Andrew. But you tell us, what's the reaction you've had from parents within this very wide circle you've pulled together. Do they get your project? Are they happy? May not be the right word, but do they understand why you're pulling the thread through this very large circle of difference?
I think my underlying idea, perhaps the central idea of the book, is that each of these differences individually feels quite isolating. There aren't so many families who are dealing with schizophrenia. There aren't so many dealing with dwarfism. There aren't even so many, in a way, dealing with having children who commit crimes. Mm-hmm. But if you look at what those experiences have in common, and you say everyone who has an exceptional or challenging child has something in common with other people with an exceptional or challenging child, people are suddenly in a vast company. And I've actually had a very divided response, a sort of dialectical response, which is that some people have written to me and said, I breathed such a sigh of relief when I read this and I felt so connected to everyone else. And others have written and said, my child may have autism, but he's no criminal. Or they've said, mm-hmm. my child is a criminal, but he's not mentally ill. Or they've in some other way resisted the other categories. Mm-hmm. And I think people's resistance to them, often as they talk about it, gives the exact evidence of what all of the categories, in fact, have in common.
What is the greater point you're looking to make here by threading all of these together?
I'm looking at the idea that almost any condition can be experienced as an identity or as an illness, that it's useful to be able to look at anything in both ways. You can look at even your ethnicity or your age or anything else as an illness, and you can look at even something as extreme as crime as an identity. And what I really hope is that in this era in which the election has sort of swung to the diversity card rather than to the everyone is the same in America card, mm-hmm. that we're opening up into a society in which we can embrace the strangenesses people have, even when those strangenesses are burdensome or difficult ones.
Andrew Solomon's new book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. It is a challenging book. It is, I would also say, and I do not say this lightly or often, it's a book of genius. I want to open the phone lines right away, Andrew, because we have parents who are in this category, this very wide category, and interested in speaking with you. You're probing it so deeply here. Let's go to Betsy in Acton, Massachusetts. Betsy, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Andrew Solomon. What's your story?
Hi. Well, my story actually started in 1987, and when I gave birth to a daughter who... she's 25 now, has most recently been diagnosed with schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. They portray that often as being something that just happens suddenly when you're 25 or so, you know. But what I learned, if she indeed has schizophrenia, is that they have it pretty much from birth. Because...
Did you know? Could you feel it? Did you feel...
Oh, I knew something. Mm-hmm. I knew something was up as early, for sure, at one. Even as an infant, she was a screamy baby. She was, you know, the kind that was just constantly not happy, constantly dissatisfied. There was always something that wasn't going right. But the other side, she was a joyful toddler, as long as she was left alone. She had these great things. She was brilliant. She was just amazing how she would build towers with blocks crooked intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, but they wouldn't fall. And it was just breathtaking, and it was amazing, and it was beautiful, and it was wonderful until she went to school. Because at school, she was weird.
And so pain comes in, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. I actually, to be honest, when she was that age, I have a degree in early childhood education. And
yeah.
Through her schoolhood life, because it's only very recently that we have put the schizophrenic label on children mm-hmm. at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking Asperger's syndrome. But I was apparently the only person in Massachusetts, at least, who knew about it because I'd taken an interest in it.
Maybe then, not now. Andrew, I heard your question for Betsy.
Yes, I was just going to say Asperger syndrome, which has just been taken out of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
so it's no longer an official designation. But I think what you're pointing to is the fact that many people who will go on to develop schizophrenia have a lot of pre-schizophrenic conditions, which are sometimes mm-hmm. visible in childhood. And the problem is that many people with those same symptoms then don't go on to develop schizophrenia. So it's very hard to sort out what direction anyone is headed in.
Betsy, may I ask you,
do you feel a commonality with this very wide spectrum of differences that Andrew Solomon's putting down here? You know, deaf, dwarf, Down syndrome, autism, schizophrenia. I mean, you raised a child who was different. Do you see a common experience at some level?
A little bit, but, you know, when you're dealing, she's an incredibly difficult child, and as amazing and beautiful and wonderful and charming and enchanting as she could be absolutely horrible. She tried to push me down the stairs when she was seven, and damn near did. She was strong. There was a very bad side to the whole thing that most people didn't see. That was mostly safe for home. She was afraid at school. She would be quiet and kind of sit in the background. And I felt very alone, very, very alone, because it was clear, she was different. She was, as many of us were called as children, weird. It was like, my friend raised a very similar child. We met when our kids were babies, and they ended up being.
So when people ask you, Betsy, the ratio of blessing and burden, there's a ratio in all parenthood experiences. What about yours?
That's true. I have two other kids, so I know I know how the spectrum runs. But I'll tell you that the worst of it was how painful it was for her to be different at school and not know how not to be different. And she wanted desperately to be like the other children.
Betsy, thank you so much for your call. I hate to cut off. We've got a break here, and we will hear from more. We wish you good luck. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about children who are born different, and the parents who love them. Andrew Solomon writes about this whole realm very movingly in his big new book, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. He's a National Book Award winner in 2001 from his book on depression, The Noonday Demon. Andrew Solomon, you interviewed so many parents, families. Give us a sense of the range of reactions you found facing different kinds of difference in your work for the book.
Well, the first thing I should say is that some kinds of difference are much harder to deal with than others. And the caller we just heard from was talking about schizophrenia, which I think is among the most difficult. What I found was most empowering for people was to be able ultimately to say that while they were anguished by their child's pain, they had also been able to grow from it. And I think one has to seek to assuage the pain of the child as much as possible. And when your child is in pain, you're in pain. Mm-hmm. That's always going to be the case. Mm-hmm. But also to see whether you can learn enough through the process of negotiating your child's pain to be able to be a good parent to that child. And frequently you negotiate that by helping the child not to feel alone. I mean, the mother who just called in said that her daughter was so lonely and the experience was so lonely. And what I'm trying to examine is what the ways are to mitigate that loneliness.
Christine writes to us on Facebook, Andrew. She says, I have a child with autism, and while I appreciate your point, I'd rather try to find ways in which we are similar, and there are many.
Well, of course there are many, and my point is not to say that you should treat your child as an alien. My point is to say that you should see what you have in common with your child, what your child has in common with other children, but also how to work with the difference. If you have a child with autism and you try to say that your child is just like you, you need to change in order for that to be a valid or a useful point of view. You need to change enough to understand what your child's reality is. All of our children pull us into a different experience of reality. Seeking out those commonalities is important, but creating them is also very important.
Give us more examples of success or failure from the interviews you've done.
Well, I found, for example, that there were many parents of people who had less severe autism. Very severe autism is obviously unbelievably difficult. Children who aren't speaking and who are banging their heads against the wall. Mm-hmm. But if you're dealing with a somewhat milder version of autism, there are a lot of parents who had to say, I thought that I wouldn't feel loved if I didn't have a child who ran across the room and gave me a hug. Mm-hmm. But I've learned that my child communicates in a different language and that I have to understand things through that language and through that system of values. And once I've learned to speak in that language, which is my child's language, then I'm able to understand them. Very much the way that parents of deaf children said, I can't get them to speak, but I could learn to sign and I might be able to communicate with them and explain myself to them and give them an opportunity to explain themselves to me.
What about the parents' urge to try and create a reproduction here? Try and create a carbon copy or something close to it. Try and take the edges or even the off of or even the heart out of this different identity that their child may have.
You know, there's always a tension between accommodation and cure. And I think cure is not so bad when it's feasible, but I think it's often not feasible. So I think, for example, looking at my own parents, that they might have had an easier time if I had been straight than they did with the fact that I was gay. But there wasn't actually anything to do to make me straight, and any attempt to do that was going to be traumatic. So they had to learn to accept the life that I was going to have. And I think that's always the question. If you've got something, I also had dyslexia. Mm-hmm. They managed to help me get over that. Here I am writing books. Mm-hmm. So if it's something curable, go ahead and cure it. And if it's something that's not curable, then you need to accept it. And it really comes down to that famous serenity prayer. Give me the ability to change what needs to be changed, to accept what cannot be changed, and the wisdom to know the difference between the two.
But you point to an interesting ground in between where our openness to diversity of all kinds, it gets challenged. I mean, with cochlear implants for deaf kids these days, do you do whatever it takes to bring them hearing, or do you embrace deaf culture with its own beauty? For dwarfism, do you put them through the painful surgeries to add the extra inches, or do you not? You point right at these tensions.
You know, I've thought about it a lot, and I think if I had a child who is deaf, I would get cochlear implants for that child because I would want to be able to communicate with that child, and I think it would be an easier way to be in the world. And I say that despite having encountered great beauty in the deaf world. And if I had a child who was a dwarf, I would not put that child through limb lengthening, I don't think, because it's too painful, it occupies too much of childhood, and because I think life as a dwarf need not be as alienating as it probably looks to parents when those children are born. But I recognize that that's where I would draw the line for my own child and that other people would draw it elsewhere, and that it's helpful for everyone to understand both the identity piece and the illness piece and to be able to weigh them up and think, is this so much of a disadvantage that we really need to do something about it? Is the thing we can do about it something that's workable and feasible and not too traumatic? Or is this something where if we were only to change our system of values a little bit, we could see great beauty in the identity? And that has to be negotiated by every parent and every child. The answers are not standard. They're different for every single person.
Andrew Solomon in Far From the Tree writes about all kinds of children of difference, deaf, dwarfs, Down syndrome, autism, schizophrenia, disability, prodigies, children of rape, children who go to crime, transgender children. He says, as to the parenting, he writes, life is enriched by difficulty. Love is made more acute when it requires exertion. Groton, Connecticut, Maureen is calling. Thanks, Maureen. You're on the air with Andrew Solomon.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Andrew. Hi. I'm looking forward to reading this book. I am raising three adopted children. Two witnessed the murder of a loved one, and one of those children was very young at the time, around a year old. Due to that early childhood trauma experience, she has been presenting with a variety of mental health trauma-rooted conditions now for a few years, and some of the behaviors were present early on when she was 2.5 and 2.5 to 5, but became much worse over the age of 5. And one thing, we didn't physically have these children, and that their exposures after birth mm-hmm. are contributing to what is currently going on for them. This child is very different. The way she acts at home, interacts with the family and siblings, the way she presents at school, and there seems to be a big lack of consensus in the psychiatric community as to how to treat children and the conditions they present with when exposed to a variety of traumas within that birth to three time period. And I just want to say that, you know, in our case, we are raising a child that's different, and it's been very challenging, but the answers or the methods to maintain or help guide her don't seem to be available yet.
Maureen, what's your relationship to this challenge socially? I mean, do people see that your child is different? Do you explain, well, she or he, I'm not sure, witnessed the parents' murder, or is that just too off-putting to people so you don't bring it up? How do you, what about the social context for your challenge?
It depends. I do both depending on the setting and the people and whether or not I think they have the ability to deal with what I'm about to say.
Mm-hmm.
I am one that talks a lot about the condition as much as possible, though, because I think the more you network with people and the more you you talk about things, the more answers might present themselves. My parents were involved in AA for many years, and so I kind of embraced the idea of therapy and options and being celebratory of overcoming challenges. So for me, I think I'm in the right place to be parenting her, although it's been extremely difficult and sometimes overwhelming and full of fear. I think you do need to talk about it, and that's got a double-edged sword aspect to it, because I think it makes her feel more different sometimes if she overhears,
sure,
or if she hears another child talking about something I may have spoke to one of their parents about.
Yeah. And Andrew, what about the closest you come to trauma is children of rape. So the trauma really in a way of the mother, though traumas can echo down. Here's trauma to the child itself and the many, maybe common experience in Amy, the mother trying to find the way.
There is actually one family who are in the transgender chapter who had also adopted a child who had been through a similar experience of trauma, mm-hmm, who ultimately, I think not because of that trauma, but had emerged as transgender and who described the whole experience to me. In the first place, I think it's courageous and admirable and wonderful to adopt children who have got these difficulties and to rise to the occasion of trying to help them. The second thing is that there's always a very fragile balance between wanting to maintain your child's sense of privacy and wanting to make sure your child doesn't grow up with a feeling of secrets. And in doing the chapter about children conceived in rape, one of the questions was always, how openly do we talk about this? Mm-hmm. And I feel like you don't have to talk about it so openly that everyone in the world knows the entire story, total strangers on the bus. But you also don't want your child growing up with the sense that what's happened is shameful or that it's something people will find out. And so I think those are very difficult and tricky balances. And what one wants to say to a story like the one we've just heard, which is, I mean, unimaginable for someone to have seen those things at such an early age, is sort of, you know, if you can just love them back to being well, but you can't necessarily just love them back to being well, you can love them to being somewhat better. And the trick is to figure out how much can they be helped and what are the techniques for helping them. And I agree, I think especially this question of very early trauma, the findings are very mixed and you have to sort of decide which of the various theories that are out there you're going to listen to. I felt as though, as I worked on the book as a whole, conditions that were treatable, most parents will go out and treat. And conditions that are totally untreatable, most parents will learn to accept. And conditions that are sometimes treatable, or some people think they're treatable, or sometimes the treatment works and sometimes it doesn't, those are the ones that are hardest to negotiate, and that's the situation we're looking at here.
Amy, thank you for your call. We've got a comment from Felisa here who's listening, and she, never mind treating or accepting, she says, asks, what happens when parents have difficulty with acknowledging the unique aspects of their children? What about that challenge, Andrew?
Well, I think it's a journey that parents have to go on. And I myself in my own life, when I was younger and first coming out of the closet, I remember feeling that my parents didn't really accept me for who I was. And then I thought that they didn't really love me. And it took me a long time to understand that love and acceptance are two very different things. So some people neither love nor accept their children. But there are many people who love their children but really can't quite accept who they are. And they have to go through a process of learning and, in effect, of studying their children. But these children can be very alien and very foreign and very bewildering. And there are lots of people who aren't really fully up for it. And my hope in the book was to tell enough stories of people who went through often a difficult, often a traumatic, often a complicated, sometimes a joyful experience toward acceptance, and to try to give some models for how you might go about coming to feel at ease with your own child.
You're right. Having exceptional children exaggerates parental tendencies. Those who would be bad parents become awful parents, you write. But those who would be good parents often become extraordinary. Andrew Solomon writes, I take the anti-Tolstoyan view that the unhappy families who reject their variant children have much more in common while the happy ones who strive to accept them are happy in a multitude of ways. What did you see? What have you seen, Andrew?
Well, I would take, for example, one family I talked to who had a child with Down syndrome, and they became very involved in changing the way people with Down syndrome are educated and ultimately got involved in really helping to shift the dialogue around inclusion. And their son is now 30, and I said to the parents, tell me about all of this. Do you wish you'd never heard of Down syndrome? Do you wish your child didn't have it? It's been such a big piece of your life. And his mother said, you know, for our son, I wish he didn't have Down syndrome, because for our son, it's a difficult way to be in the world, mm-hmm. and I'd like to make his life easier. But speaking for myself, though I would never have believed 30 years ago when he was born that I could come to such a point, speaking for myself, it's made my life so much better and so much richer than it could ever have been otherwise, that speaking for myself, I wouldn't give it up for anything in the world.
I was really moved by that. Their son was David, and you wrote, you know, for David, she said, I'd cure it in an instant, but for us, I wouldn't exchange these experiences for anything. They've made us who we are, and who we are is so much better than who we would have been otherwise. This, the mother of a Down syndrome child. I had a brother who was Down syndrome. He didn't live long, but it opened the window, and you could feel the family's entire attention turned, all right, how do we address this? The father of a best friend who was schizophrenic taught me a lot, but opening to that. I mean, what about people outside these families and their readiness, willingness to open, to begin to understand the magnitude of difference and its potential beauty, Andrew?
Well, my reason for writing about families is that I think that they are the ones who translate the experience of children who often can't communicate for themselves what their experience are, or who are in some way enclosed by that experience, to the larger society. That in a way, parents are a metaphor for the larger society. You try to win your parents' acceptance as a means of winning social acceptance. Mm-hmm. And in a way, they're a metaphor for the children. Society accepts the families as a step on the way to accepting the children. I think that if you try to talk only about the people who belong to these actual stigmatized categories, you're talking about people who can't always do as much for themselves as they might like. I think you need to look at these families. And I found that frequently, it was very striking to me, there was the family of someone who was transgender, who came from Helena, Montana, and I went with her back to her town when she had a kind of triumphant moment there. I won't go through the whole story, mm-hmm. but she was warmly embraced. She had made a film. She received a standing ovation. People were cheering for her. And I said, so many people who are transgender have so much trouble with this. And here you are, and here's your mother standing up here beside you. I said, why do you think that you haven't been rejected by your community? And her mother said, I'd like to think it's because of the way we've lived our lives up until this time. And I think that's often the case. I think people who have managed to have powerful relationships outside of their family can then translate what goes on inside of their family out into the world. And Carol said, I'm not responsible for my child. I'm not responsible for who my child has become. But I am responsible to my child. And I love my child, and I always will. And that's all I need to know. And I hope no one else here needs to know anything besides that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about children who are born different and the parents who love them. Andrew Solomon is with us. His big book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. He joins us from New York. Andrew, Matt writes to us. He says, my 2-year-old son is a mini-me, physically and in interests, which strokes my ego, but I'm eager to see how he falls from the tree. I mean, that's kind of back to where we started here, the initial expectation, maybe hope in some ways. You think, you say very often, parents are looking for immortality in a child that's kind of just themselves, but younger, who will live longer. And yet here's the big turn for those for whom that's not the way ahead.
Well, it's the adventure of all parenting. I mean, your child is, of course, a hand reaching out into the future, and I feel as though I'm reaching into the future. But I look at my own children, and I'm sometimes delighted to think, look how much we share in common. These things I value, they seem to value too. I mean, they're very little and hard fully to know. But I hope I'll be awake to the ways in which they'll change me. Some parents have an idea that what parenting involves is making your children like you. And I think a lot of what it involves is allowing your children to make you like them.
Roxanne in New York, Jamestown, New York. Thanks for calling, Roxanne. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Very interesting subject. I have a son who's 42 who cannot stay out of prison. He gets out, and before his parole is up, he's back in. It's the same crime every time. He steals from where he works, money.
Mm-hmm.
But it started when he was younger, and I would make him go to the store. I'd go with him. He had to take whatever he stole back and apologize. But at a young age, he would call himself retarded and run away. And when I would take him for, you know, evaluation, counseling, they'd say, oh, no, he's a fine boy. He has goals. He's, you know, motivated. And I could never get help for him.
How have you come to relate to him, Roxanne, then, to Andrew's, you know, call?
Right. I support him. When he's in prison, I either visit or write or talk to him on the phone. I can't give him money, but when he comes out, I used to let him come back to my home, and then I had a younger daughter, and I thought that's not a good idea, but I am always there for him. And when he is out of prison, he's a wonderful son. I mean, I'm elderly, 60, whatever, and he makes sure I have everything I need. So there's a very loving relationship between us.
Do you wonder where he came from? I mean, you know where he came from, but why he's this way? How do you think about that?
I do all the time. When he was 9 months old, we were separated. I had to have a surgery, and I was in the hospital for a while and then recuperating. So I always wonder, is it the bond thing, or that he wasn't with his sister? I don't know. I think all the time. I think he's bipolar and undiagnosed and needs to be on meds. But because that didn't happen when he was younger, he's not the type to go seek that counseling now.
Roxanne, thank you for your call. Andrew, you've got a whole chapter on crime here and families dealing with children who tend to crime. What are you hearing there? What did you find?
So I have a few things to say in response to that description. The first of which is that a lot of the time we think of criminality as being effectively an identity, or at least socially determined. And my experience was that while there are some families in which bizarre family dynamics have doubtless contributed to a child being somewhat dysfunctional, that by and large, crime seems to be something that emerges full-fledged and seemed to me to be as much like an illness as autism or schizophrenia. So we don't have the ability yet to scan the brain of the man whose mother we've just been talking to, but I'd bet when we do, we'll discover that there are things that cause that, that his inclination to steal makes him very different from most of us who don't just not steal because we'd go to jail. We don't steal because it seems wrong to us, or the idea makes us uncomfortable, or whatever it is. We have all of these reasons for not doing it. So first is this thing of crime as being really an illness a lot of the time. Not all the time, but a lot of the time. The second thing is that I think we've just heard this thing of thinking, I had this surgery, I was absent, and so somehow that was what caused it. I found that because as a society, we so relentlessly blame the parents of criminals, that the parents of criminals I met all blamed themselves. Now, 50 years ago, we said that autism was caused by refrigerator mothers. We said schizophrenia was caused by parents who had a subconscious wish that their child not exist. 200 years ago, we said that deformity and dwarfism were caused by the lascivious imaginings of mothers. There's this endless thing of blaming mothers, which leads to an endless thing of mothers blaming themselves. And I think crime is an area in which we still blame mothers incredibly acutely. And I think it's not fair, and I also think it's not productive. it does sound like our child may have a mental illness. If he's 42, then when he was little, children weren't diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. I have no idea whether that's what he has. There's not enough information to begin to make that judgment, even if I were a diagnostician, which I'm not. But I think that the problem of trying to help people who have something that might be treatable but are resistant to having it treated is perhaps the most frustrating one there is in parenthood.
Roxanne, thank you for your call. Let me go to Rachel, if I may. Watertown, Massachusetts. Rachel, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Talking a lot about kids whose behaviors make them seem different, I have a son who has Marfan syndrome, and we've known about it since he was very little. I'm 5'6". At 11 years old, he was my height, and at 18 years old now, he's 6 feet 10 inches. So he can't hide. Wherever we go, people notice, people point him out.
How does Marfan syndrome present itself, Rachel?
In any number of ways, one of which a side effect, as I suppose you could say, is extreme height. There are also heart issues that can be related to it. He has only minor health issues connected to that, but it's a connective tissue issue.
But does he seem unusual to people when he's out and about apart from his height or not?
Oh, yes. Apart from his height is not a phrase that really you could use, because as soon as he walks in, he's noticed. I mean, he's extraordinary. You know, your average tall man is, 6'3 or something, and he's 7 inches taller than them.
Yeah.
So wherever we go, in fact, his father had Marfan syndrome as well, and I used to joke that if we had been walking down the street together and I had been stark naked, people would have said, "Who's that tall guy? Wow, he's really tall."
Yeah.
Because that's all anybody notices. And the same goes for my son. But he deals with it with great equanimity. He's friendly and kind to people who comment. I raised him, telling him that people come in all different shapes and sizes, and that was who he was. When he was little on the playground, I taught him to introduce himself with his name and his age, because if he started playing with a bunch of 8-year-olds when he was 5 and they expected him to follow the 8-year-old rules and he wasn't developmentally able to do that, I wanted him to know right out. But he gets all the basketball questions and this and that, and it has a lot to do with how he is perceived in the world, but I think he is very comfortable with who he is, and he recognizes that this is just part of his identity, but it's not the whole of his identity.
Is it easier because, did you say his father has the same thing? So his father's also very, does that make it easier for you?
He is deceased now, but his grandfather died of this. He had an aortic aneurysm, so mm-hmm. there's always this...
There's an element of continuity there, even though he's dealing with it alone. I mean, not with his father, anyway.
But his father was the only person with Marfan syndrome that he ever met until he was 16 years old. He never met anybody else dealing with the same health issues. So in that sense, he was very alone. And he sticks out wherever he goes, and he has since he was very little. So it's not something he can avoid.
Rachel, thank you for sharing that. If I may, Andrew, what about community for the children who find themselves in this circumstance? They're very different by some measure. Their family may or may not accept them fully. You describe all ranges in here. What about that next community, the community of like people if they can find it?
I thought about writing about Marfan syndrome, actually. It's something that's interested me a lot. And I felt that since I was writing about dwarfism, I was not going to do both. Mm. But one of the dwarfs I wrote about said to me, going out in public, he said, it's like being a celebrity without the glamour or the money, which I thought was a wonderful description of sort of how frustrating it can be to be so unbelievably visibly different the minute you walk into a room. And I now have various friends who are dwarfs, and it's really striking to me. I'll go out to lunch with someone and I feel like if I walked into the restaurant with a ring-tailed lemur, I couldn't get more astonished stares from everyone all around me. People, furtively staring, people directly staring, so on and so forth. But I think for many people who have got a difference like that, if they can find a community of people where that difference is less noticeable because others share it, then people break through. So when I went to my first dwarf convention while I was working on my dwarfism chapter, I thought that I was going to it because it was all about how short everyone was. And then I got there and I realized it was the only place where it didn't matter what people's height was. For all of these dwarfs who were there with all of these other dwarfs, no one was staring at them for being dwarfs. People were noticing whether they were good looking, whether they were funny, whether they were kind, mm-hmm. whether they whatever their other qualities were. And I feel as though, I mean, Marfan syndrome is difficult because it's a much rarer condition mm-hmm. even than dwarfism, which is already quite a rare condition. So it's hard to find that community, but it can often be an unbelievable liberation. And one person after the next who I met said, when I discovered deaf culture, when I discovered the Little People of America, when I discovered the autism rights movement, when I discovered the world of people who were transgender, when I discovered a world of other people who were prodigies and who were therefore having conversations that didn't make any sense to their age peers, all of these people, as they discovered their world, there was this enormous breathing out of thinking, all right, within this context, I'm normal. And once I've had that experience, I can carry it out into the larger world and into my interactions with people to whom I am not normal. Mm.
Terry in Newton, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Terry.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Solomon. Thank you so much. I'm so excited to hear this because I come from a family growing up with very pragmatic parents as they and it's where I learned that there's with so many kids with so many issues. One is one was a criminal in a state penitentiary. There were two millionaires. One's a hoarder. One is a schizophrenic. And I have two children with autism, and then another child that has a chronic illness that was very debilitating for him with the drugs he had to have while he was in high school.
So what's the delight you find in Andrew's take on this, Terry?
My delight is that so much – my delight is that it's out there and that you've taken the time and the energy to talk with people like myself as parents and also so that our voices can get out there and our stories that these people are so important to our culture as kind people, as giving people, as people that embrace differences, even that's such a cliche now, where it can be funny, happy, ridiculously amazing in the way it can change a person in the sense that I see every leaf in my life, not just the whole tree. There is, it slows you down. It makes everything worthwhile. And the fun stuff, such as going out with your husband on a date, is just like the first time because so much energy is put in to helping these children be so okay about who they are, knowing very well that they're loved. And my thing is, if you're loved in the home, that's all you need. That's all you need to make it through.
Terry, bless you. Our time is short. Let me take that good effusion to Andrew. I mean, there's something right there. Terry's put her finger right on it. You quote Wallace Stevens, the poet, right at the front of the book, saying, "The imperfect is our paradise." And you are, in a way, championing this difference, which we've so long, even in this time of diverse celebration of diversity, we still define many of these as horrible, awful, difficult, must avoid at all costs. You're pointing there, as, in a way, as a kind champion of this, Andrew. Why? What is it?
I wouldn't ever want to trivialize the difficulty that people are experiencing or to say, you know, this is all wonderful and what a shame that your child doesn't have a deformity or a mental illness. I mean, obviously, we want our children to be as healthy as possible. We all want that. I want it for my own children. But I think that there has been too much of a tendency to assume that people who are different should be marginalized, that they somehow compromise the mainstream, that they make us weaker, and that they are the defects that keep us from being the strongest social entity, the strongest family, the strongest person, the strongest country that we can be. And my view is that in just the same way that a variety of species, that diversity is necessary for the continuance of the planet, so likewise, I think this diversity of experience is necessary to keep alive the kind of ecosphere of kindness, and that if we're able to look at all of these strangenesses and difficulties and differences and say, we wouldn't have chosen this, But what meaning or what strength is there in it that we make a better and more just world? I think it couldn't be more profoundly important to me.
You quote Rumi as well. You say, Rumi said that the light enters you at the bandaged place. And you say, this book's conundrum is that most of the families described here facing all these challenges have ended up grateful for experiences they would have done anything to avoid. I guess you feel some confidence that they would say yes indeed to that.
Yes. I mean, I think they probably wouldn't have chosen to have these experiences, but I think once they had them, if they were determined to look into them and to find some kind of light or some kind of occasion for growth in them, that liberated them to be good parents to their children. And ultimately, I thought what matters is not whether the meaning is there, it's whether the meaning is sought. And the book encourages people to do that seeking.
Andrew Solomon, the book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. There's a good excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Andrew Solomon joining us today from New York. Andrew, thank you very much for being with us. Thanks for all the work. Thanks for the book. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Amata, Mark Kilstein, Alex Kingsbury, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell. With help from Charlotte McDonald and Arjun Singh, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.